is the One Ocean Hub podcast.
Hello and welcome to the One Ocean Hub podcast, episode 6, part 2, The Island Stories, Colonial Pasts and Policies of the Present. And in this part, we pick up where we left off in our chat with the Hub co-investigator, Alana Lancaster, from the University of West Indies in Barbados, and with the Hub doctoral researcher, Lisa Winnie, who is coming from the Solomon Islands and who's doing her PhD at the Centre for Environmental Law and Governance at the University of Strathclyde here with us in Glasgow. So I've been curious, have you been able to learn from the research program that we're on here at the One Ocean Hub via the international work and maybe learning from in-country research? And when I say in-country, I mean the focus country, Hub's focus countries, the African focus countries like Ghana, Namibia and South Africa. How much of that Hub work is relevant to your own work in the Caribbean? And what would be some ideas that you might want to implement in your context, the island context, the Caribbean context? What would be those ideas that would be useful in the Caribbean, if any?
The way in which I previously taught international environmental law, you teach it as, you know, discrete areas of international environmental law, and then you maybe touch on some what we call crossover topics, you know, like international law and trade and international law and in the international financial system, which I suppose, looking back, these were the areas which were flagged when I was training because of their massive importance, like especially for developing economies. But even though, for example, I did a human rights law and law of the sea in my training, you do learn the economic, social, and cultural rights. You learn that there's part 12 of the Law of the Sea Convention. But one of it's almost that, you know, they're done in basically silos and isolation without bringing them together and realizing that in the, you know, the environment in which we're operating, they're really tremendous synergies, and they, for effective solutions, they need to be synergies. So I think my work in the legal and international group has helped me not only in my thinking, but it also in the way in which I teach, and also certainly when I'll be developing, so one of the things I've been tasked with doing is developing a specialization addressing ocean governance and climate justice, for example. The linkages between human rights and the environment in small scale fisheries, for example. I've also been able to delve more deeply into areas that are extremely interesting to me. So areas beyond national jurisdiction, and the international legally binding instrument and how that links to the, for example, the ocean climate nexus. Customary law, and as I said before, one of the things being in the customary law group really helped reinforce some of the lessons I learned in history, but never contextualized them with respect to law and policy and what I researched or did. I also happy to say I've been able to explore a lot of very important work in children's rights and the ocean, as well as oceans and human health, and being able to collaborate with not only early career researchers on transdisciplinarity in the ocean, but also both global north and global south researchers, and this is perhaps makes us closer to Lisa in some respects than it does some of my African colleagues, some but not all, is that we are considered small island developing states. And that comes with its own inherent set of risk and considerations.
Yeah, so in terms of innovative methods of silo breaking and the opportunity to really work in an interdisciplinary manner has yielded insights that you can really apply on the particular context in which you work on, but at the same time that there are idiosyncrasies of the island contexts that are intrinsic.
Yes.
There is something that has to be both researched and sort of like contended with in its own very sort of custom and customary way, right?
Yeah.
And the context is also, it's historical, and it's as much as it is environmental. And it sort of pertains to the islandness of the place.
Right. And I think even between islands, I'm sure Lisa would agree, one island is not another, you know, there are subtle differences. I mean, you know, and while there's similarities, even though all islands are not equal in the sense that even from a perspective of if we were to say we're all small island developing states and we do quite a bit of negotiation as blocks, as EOSIS as it's called, climate change, plastics, and so on, across Africa, Caribbean, and Pacific states, and we also have a few in Asia, and the Indian Ocean, we are different. So, for example, the Pacific states are literally, truly large ocean states because while we do have some extreme examples, so Barbados and Antigua and Barbuda are, you know, 388 times, 200 and something times. They, you know, many Pacific states are just such, you know, it's such intriguing that basically your state of what, you know, of ocean. One of the things I think ultimately I'm increasingly seeing is that the similarities. So I always knew something about the Caribbean. We have similarities, but we have differences. But it's not only a Caribbean thing, across the oceans and so. And I'm forever intrigued by, I guess I'm less intrigued now by the similarities, but more of the differences that still make us similar, if that makes any sense. I think that's what it intrigues me the most. Kind of linked to the similarities and how we can then build out from that.
Yeah. How peculiarities.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I think that's a better way of putting it.
But yeah, I mean, this comes from being landlocked and thinking about islands a lot.
Yes.
Islands are, each of them are peculiar, like each island or each archipelago, yeah, or each island actually is in the league of its own. And it's, yeah, like it's a unique entity with its customs, with its animal, plant species, cultures, human and other than human behaviors, currents, ways, endemisms, all that. So I really love, yeah, I love what you said about that you're more intrigued by the differences, that the sum of which is actually the similarity.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
such a more adequate way of putting it.
Yeah.
Please use that.
When we come across narratives that talk about how the diversity is problematic, and for me, it's like, no, that's the strength. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, Lisa, and you, Alana, as well, what is it about islandness or island life, or working with or researching on islands and with island communities that you covered that people who don't come from this context don't know? What's a complete given to you, and what researchers or decision makers or these sort of like externally imposed forces, be it a science that's not accustomed to the custom, or just the people who try to govern on a more global level, do not know, and somebody who hails from an island just knows it in their bones as a given, be them a researcher or just a local person.
What do we feel now? I think it may be changing a bit now, but one of the things that I've always liked about, you know, as I began to travel through the Caribbean, is this sense of, I don't, maybe community is the right way of saying it. You know, it's, even if we have our internal differences. I think one of the ways it manifests again across the Caribbean is, you know, food, you know. I find that it manifests in not only similarities in food, but the way in which food features in relationship and culture, you know. I've been in so many places in the Caribbean. People don't know me from Adam, as we would say. But, you know, they see you there, you might be, they realize you're a stranger. It's usually easy to say that, see that. And they invite you into their life. They help you. They feed you. And even if, you know, food is scarce, and that just develops a sense of community and belonging.
So these close communities, right? Sharing their food, however scarce, with everyone, sharing their joy of life and vitality and the colors and the aromas and the fragrances of the place and the music and the dance that are embedded in the places where they live and they're from in the Caribbean and perhaps beyond on other islands that we're talking about. We're talking about a global issue here. There are also challenges that these communities are constantly up against. So I was hoping that you could speak a little bit to these challenges that the people from the small island developing states face when attempting to access the international processes and the decision-making fora that determine the fate of the small island developing states in the current rapidly changing climate in our increasingly vulnerable ocean.
You know, as small island developing states in general, often participation, and this comes to meaningful participation in processes. You know, a lot of the international processes, especially with oceans and climate change, rely on, you know, global engagement because they're global issues. And it's often more challenging for historical, economic, and a lot of other reasons for persons from many island states, including small island states, to arrive to participate in these processes. And I had a discussion about a month ago on this in relation, because I was given, in order to attend the Ocean Decade Conference, for example, as someone from a small island state. And I told the person who was facilitating this that I really do think that they need to understand the context in which many persons or what it takes to attend these conferences. Because there seems to be a disconnect. So saying, okay, you're going to support people from developing states or small island states really doesn't mean anything unless you actually ensure that they're effective mechanisms. If it wasn't for my determination to attend, it would not have happened. And I'm just thinking, if this were a COP or where a critical decision had to be made, and I'm talking it can range from financing, many require visas. So that's in itself a lot of process. You know, these are things that if we really want to see globally engaged and meaningful governance of our oceans, climate change, biodiversity, we need to relook and reassess how we could make participation meaningful, because it's just not adequate anymore to say we're ticking that box and we don't really care or not whether they arrive or not. We are at a stage where it needs to be meaningful and engaged participation.
Yeah. I absolutely and wholeheartedly agree. I was there with you in Barcelona, and I was also helping many of our colleagues from Africa trying to apply for a visa, and before that to even get registered for the conference, to even start the process of applying for a visa, as this was needed, a confirmation of the secured space at the conference was needed to be even considered for a Schengen visa, right? And then they go through a very, very, very expensive and lengthy process, risking to maybe even not get the visa at the end of it. And then obviously to be subjected to the European prices that are getting more and more preposterously unaffordable from the people traveling from the global south, and maybe particularly from the small island developing states. So yeah, I'm really glad that you flagged this up. So many obstacles to arrive and take part in the conversation about the ocean while being an islander. So profoundly intertwined and dependent on the ocean, if you're an islander, yeah? And being vulnerable to the climate change effects of the ocean, being in the forefront of these vulnerabilities. And I think that this is something that is good to flag, that needs to be flagged, that has to be improved in the context of the UN Ocean Decade and beyond, in other discussion and decision-making ocean-related fora, for sure. And that needs to be improved in order to achieve a meaningful and impactful participation from the people from the global south and from the people of the small island, from the small island states, in earnest and in real life, right? And where it matters, as you said, and not just on paper. But that's also a segue to my question to Lisa, who has taken part in the plenary in Barcelona, and the plenary session that where you shared some key messages that were absolutely crucial, super important, and brilliant, in my opinion. The session was, how can a healthy ocean improve human health and enhance well-being on a rapidly changing planet? And a lot of your contribution, Lisa, pertained to the local knowledge and the knowledge of local people. There were other things that you flagged there. And I would just like you, if you can, to help us reminisce on what these messages were and what was the context.
Yes, again, this is another indigenous wisdom. I think for me, my lived experience, I've always seen how it's about balance. It's about ensuring that there's enough food. It's about ensuring that the water is clean. It is about ensuring that the air is safe. It's about having a clean environment for life to be sustained. And that has been how people are with their places. They ensure that the place is good enough for life to prevail. So I think that's something that we need to be again reminded, that we ourselves have been destroying our planet. And it is time that we go back to the fundamental value of life, how we relate to other life around us, because that is a way of ensuring that not only the ocean is healthy, but it's reciprocal. It gives us a healthy support system as well. One thing I've noticed, this is reflecting after the ocean decade, is that I realized that in our communities, mental health is not an issue yet. And coming out into the world, I see it is a very big issue. And it is an issue we need to talk about, we need to address, and we need to look to our Indigenous communities for the solutions, because they have recognized it centuries ago that the environment needs to be healthy in order for life to prevail.
Let me check if I'm getting this right. You're saying that these problems that definitely plague the current neoliberal capitalist, quote unquote, mainland world, right? The West, the global North, what have you. The problems such as the life of disconnect from our surroundings, from our environment. While we're wondering how come everything and everyone is ridden by mental health and spiritual problems. You're saying that these problems have not yet arrived to the Solomons? Or is it that they're looming, but they're not yet recognized as mental health problems? I mean, is the mainland also trying to subsume the Solomons and its people and their way of knowing and their way of living into its own disembodied technocratic predicament?
Mental health is not yet a big issue. It will become a big issue for us if our communities keep on hearing that their world is not good enough. that their knowledge is not good enough, that their way of life is not good enough. And it comes through noble things like research, education. And this is something that us as the hub can do to bring out and elevate these places that have solutions for us in this global crisis.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for this, because it's definitely a measured warning with the hopeful roof to it. And that's beautiful. So thank you so much for this, sincerely. My next question will then be to Alana, related to what you've just said. I think that, Alana, you were exploring, or you've been exploring, the notion of the interaction of like gender and ocean and customary law and ocean, and the way in which that can be explored with the local people, with the people who know that place in their body, in their bones, in their custom, in their generation. And you were thinking maybe around some ideas about amphitheater and extending the sort of theater making methodologies into the Caribbean. Is that something that you would like to explore, or is that something that's early days? Can you tell us a little bit more about how to co-research this with the local peoples?
Yeah, certainly early days. One of the light bulbs, I suppose, that went off when I attended the first amphitheater, because, you know, during I'd heard about the term, I think I was half sold, because I'm a huge theater. I love plays, as I said, my mom was English language and literature. So one of the, I think, the things we had in common was Shakespeare. She always had a Shakespeare quote for some situation in life. We'd attend plays and so together. I thought to myself, this is interesting because it's research, so it's based on research, a community issue, so it's not some pie in the sky thing, for want of a better word. I thought of it as a brilliant tool both for engaging with communities as well as on the level of policymakers that can serve as a bridge for which academia, so the academia could provide or with in collaboration with the community. I also think it's an excellent tool for ocean literacy in general, which I think in all of the discussion, be it implementing new legislation or putting policy in place, in implementing new laws and doing a lot of the policy changes you want to effect, ocean literacy or environmental literacy, but of course I'm focusing on ocean, is supremely important. It has to happen in tandem with a lot of the research and policy change we're hoping to achieve. So in many ways, it can therefore be aligned with many of the existing as well as proposed research areas within the Caribbean region. We, about 3 years ago, launched a new faculty called the Faculty of Culture, Creative, and Performing Arts. And I think it would be a good crossing over, a meeting point between the Faculty of Law, which I find myself in, and the Faculty of Culture, Creative, and Performing Arts. And we're also establishing some links with the Center for Environmental Management. We're doing some work on women and small scale fisheries and climate justice.
Mm-hmm. And this potential collaboration opens all sorts of routes to bring together a truly diverse group of stakeholders to the same table, right? As well as to potentially illuminate or enhance impact of the work of the of the Caribbean scholars. It's a vast expanse, right? Scholars, decision makers, and communities. You have recently took part, and this is super impressive, I think, the outcome of it as well. You recently took part in an Inter-American court process, right? And you, Alana, have also took an integral part in forging new partnerships within the University of West Indies in Barbados, where you work, where you teach. Could you tell us a little bit about these multiple synergies and achievements?
So we recently, in the last 2 weeks, did an MOU with Inter-American Court, and we've enhanced our relationship with the Special Rapporteur in Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights for the Inter-American Commission, RIDESCA, between the University of the West Indies and Association of Commonwealth Universities to establish what is called a Center for Oceanography and the Blue Economy. So there are many synergies potentially within both the UWE system, the wider Caribbean region, as well as the neighboring Latin American region, that I see that this can connect.
No, that's brilliant. So like you were talking about wishing to break the silos, and there's so many synergies there that there's many a silo to be very promptly smashed. I will definitely watch that space, and we all will follow the further connections that you're about to make. It's such a humongous and fascinating body of work.
Awesome. Thank you, Melissa. I quite enjoyed discussion.
So thank you so much for sharing these absolute pearls from across the ocean of knowledge, of enthusiasm, of creativity, of expertise, and of work, and of just sheer spirit. So thank you both so much.
Thank you, Tomas, Melissa, and Alana. It was a great conversation with you today.
Thank you, Lisa and Melissa, for a wonderful afternoon. And to island women.
Yay!
For those who, even in mind, body, and spirit.
Yeah, we're taking Melissa to the islands.
We adopted her, yes.
This is the One Ocean Hub podcast.